Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 341, recorded on Friday, April 6th, 2018. Billy Gallagher, author of How to Turn Down $1 Billion, The Snapchat Story. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. Stop crime before it happens and help make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Go to ring.com/triangulation and get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit. And by FreshBooks. Join over 10 million people using FreshBooks to painlessly send invoices, track time, and capture expenses. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/triangulation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of Triangulation here at TWiT. I'm Jason Howell, and I'm going to go ahead and admit it right off the top. I am not the world's heaviest Snapchat user. I am one of those people that when it comes to Snapchat, I jump into it, I play around with it a little bit, and then I scratch my head and I go, for whatever reason, it flew over my head. But I know there's something to it because we talk about it here at TWiT all the time. So I'm super excited to have a chat with Billy Gallagher, who is the author of How to Turn Down $1 Billion, The Snapchat Story. How you doing, Billy?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
So I have to imagine you've done a lot of these interviews since you released the book a few months ago. How many of the interviewers, the people that you're talking with, have admitted their kind of lack of competency with Snapchat?
Almost all of them. There's been a couple reporters who are early to mid-20s who are like, oh, yeah, like I know what a streak is, and I Snapchat my friends, and I'll send a Snapchat of us doing the podcast. And then many of them are like, yeah, so I'm not entirely sure what this is, but welcome to the show.
See, like, I feel like I understand a lot of the components that make Snapchat successful, you know, who the target market is that it's really resonates with. I talk to a lot of, you know, my nieces, my nephews. Of course, my kids are too young to actually use it, but they're fascinated by it. At least my 8-year-old daughter is, because she's heard other kids talk about it. So I understand the components of it, but I can speak for myself. I'm of the generation of the internet generation where we're so used to permanence that it's hard to like pull out of that mindset and be okay with this ephemeral approach. I guess that's the challenge.
I think there's definitely a generational aspect to it. I think, you know, so when I got on MySpace, I was in middle school, and then I got on Facebook in high school, and then Instagram and Snapchat towards the end of college. And so for me, like who I was as a person was very different in each of those stages. And so the impermanence makes a lot of sense to me and people of my age and particularly even younger. I think the problem for a lot of people who are older is they came on Facebook as a more formed person. And so permanence makes a lot more sense to them. There's also the even younger generation that I think is just much more visual learners. And so they'll pick up an iPad, an iPhone, Snapchat, any different app and like just play around with it and quickly pick it up. Whereas a lot of us who are older are sort of like, I need an instruction book or I need Facebook tell me what I'm clicking on versus just these crazy buttons all over Snapchat.
Or this idea that the app that you're using on a daily basis is, I hate to use the word a toy, but it's less of a, I mean, it is a Snapchat is absolutely a communication tool, but the way that they've created it, and your book illustrates it perfectly, how it was built up, the foundation was built around it. It was meant to be a fun experience. And I know, like, if I'm good to go back in time to when I was a kid, if I had been introduced to Snapchat, I guarantee you I would have loved it. But for whatever reason, my boring grown-up mind says, no, we've got to work. It's not time for play. So that's my problem, not theirs, I suppose. They're not hurting, so it doesn't matter.
That's interesting comparing the like lofty missions of a lot of companies like Facebook's connecting the world, which for better or for worse, we can talk about that. But you know, Facebook has this lofty mission, whereas Evan Spiegel talks a lot about, we just want to have fun. We want to have fun for our users and create fun experiences. So it's a really interesting comparison.
Right on. Well, so before we kind of dive into Snapchat itself, thought we could kind of start off with you. Obviously, you're the author of this book. You've got kind of your paths have crossed very directly with the main people that really built up Snapchat. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about your time at Stanford, how your paths intersected and led you to writing this book?
Yeah, definitely. So I came out to Stanford in the fall of 2010 as a freshman. And Evan Spiegel, Bobby Murphy, and Reggie Brown were in the same fraternity as I was. They left the fraternity by the time I joined. A little complicated backstory. Read the book if you want to know that. But we were kind of knew each other at school. And then when I was a sophomore, I started writing for the tech blog, TechCrunch. Mm-hmm. And actually, funnily enough, my very first story was about Snapchat and very first interview for TechCrunch was Evan Spiegel. This was May of 2012 when they just raised a seed round. So kept following the story from there, covered Snapchat and other Stanford companies like DoorDash and Klinkle for a couple years, and then eventually wrote a book about them. So very much intertwined. And I'm actually back at Stanford right now getting my MBA. So it's been tough to leave this place.
Yeah, right. Well, and not only are you doing that, you're also, like you mentioned, at Coastal Ventures as an analyst. What exactly does that entail?
Yeah, so I worked on the investment team at Coastal from 2014 to 2016, doing early stage consumer tech investing. So we were investors in DoorDash, Instacart, a whole bunch of different consumer companies that are super interesting, and had a great experience there. It was fantastic to learn sort of the investing side of things instead of just writing about these companies.
Yeah, no, I can completely understand that. At this point in time, I mean, you're still relatively young, but you've done a lot. You've obviously accomplished a lot. Not very many people could say that they've written a book, so that's awesome. I don't know how you do it. What would you say is your greatest achievement in your professional life so far?
I would say so far it's been the book. People always ask me, like, how long did it take you? And I have a really hard time answering because if you think about covering the company and the research of Stanford and Snapchat, it's been since early 2012. The actual writing of the book has been since late 2015 when I got my book deal. And I'm still talking about it, still working on it, still thinking about it all the time. And so to work on something for so many years and to build on it and to have this physical product that I created into the world is really, really satisfying.
Sure. It's got to be really, super satisfying after all that time to finally have something to point at and to, you know, be able to hold up to people and show where all that work ended up. So I guess we can kind of start a little bit. I thought we'd kind of take some time to kind of jump through some of the highlights of the book, the moments in time that made Snapchat and later Snap what it is today. And we can go from there, but I think a large part of what's interesting about the first part of this book is a lot of new information kind of shared around those early days of Snapchat before it was Snapchat. And I guess that all starts at Stanford. You have I would say a direct relationship with Evan Spiegel, Bobby Murphy, Reggie Brown. How deep did that go? And did you get any cooperation from them in regards to the book over the years?
Yeah, so I didn't get official participation. I didn't get to interview Evan, Bobby, and Reggie for the book. Reggie later on sued the company and then settled for a lofty sum of $160 million, give or take. So he was not able to talk for the book. And then Snapchat helped me out with like fact checking and some like PR work, but did not help me with interviews. So I'd interviewed Evan and Bobby before for TechCrunch, but not for the book. And then I'd obviously been around for some of these events and had a lot of other sources from TechCrunch and otherwise. So it was a lot of other sources that helped out a lot.
Sure. While you were at Stanford, kind of crossing paths with them, like, what were they like? What are the personality traits of Evan Spiegel then that we're so used to seeing now? I mean, he's a pretty secretive person, and by extension, so is Snapchat. But was it always that way, or was he a lot more outspoken then?
Yeah, he was definitely a big personality. Had a really strong belief in his convictions. He threw a lot of his energy into planning parties instead of doing Snapchat. But it was interesting, sort of whatever he had cooking, that was what he put 110% of his energy into. So I talked about this in the book, where it starts off with designing like tank tops for his dorm, like something super silly, and then it's fraternity parties, and then it's this company he and Bobby Murphy started called Future Freshman that totally failed, and then finally it's Snapchat. And so he's always just sort of running from thing to thing, and very rarely was it classes. It was usually some side hustle he was working on. So Evan was really a big personality. He was somewhat secretive in the early days, but definitely became more, very much more secretive during Snapchat.
Once he knew that he had captured lightning in a bottle, somewhat, I guess, you know, you either are super vocal about it so everybody knows, or you let the product speak for itself. It kind of seems that ends up being the way that he goes. Did it put a lot of pressure on you as you were writing the book to not have that cooperation? I mean, I have to imagine you had to get kind of creative with how you get this information and, you know, in a legitimate way.
Yeah, definitely. There was definitely some pressure, and definitely wanted to approach it as a serious journalist, not as just someone who's writing with people they knew in college.
Sure.
I think it also maybe the pressure was definitely a good thing for me, and that it made me become more creative, maybe made me think about who intersects this story in every single part of the way, and who can I talk to? Every single interview I did, I said, who else should I talk to? What can you show me? What emails, calendar invites, documents can you point me to? Who else can you... you know, recommend I talk to that you know, I can't even say that you told me to talk to them, but I can kind of cold email them. So I think official access, obviously it would have been great to talk to those guys and hear some of their stories. But I think you can also really quickly fall victim to just talking to the people that the company officially leads you to. And that can lead you, I think, a very different story and a very different narrative. And so I'm grateful that I had to sort of do the hard work to find out these more interesting people and sort of the story that's not necessarily the official sanitized version.
Sure. And then I guess the other direction would be, you know, not having the official information, not having a connection to, you know, good sources. So then having to rely on kind of what we've heard, let's say, leaked out over the years through the press and all that kind of stuff. So it sounds like you were able to get in a little bit deeper all across the board. Now, one of the things that we heard about, I think it was a couple of years ago, were these leaked messages from Evan Spiegel from his Stanford days. If you're curious, people can look it up because there's some very interesting language in there and interesting things said. Overall, it really kind of reinforces this idea, at least through the now lens of the tech bro culture. You know, how do you think Evan has evolved from that point? Because obviously that was kind of an embarrassing moment in time. Snapchat was very popular, very notable when that happened. So, you know, Evan kind of had to publicly atone to those. But in retrospect, it really wasn't that long ago. Do you think he's evolved from that point?
Yeah. So we're talking about these emails Evan wrote to his fraternity pledge class list when he was about 18 or 19 years old, his freshman spring and sophomore fall. They were very offensive, lewd, misogynistic, homophobic, very, very bad emails that he wrote that leaked through Gawker, and I believe 2014, and created a big, big scandal for him and the company. I think Evan, that definitely reinforced like a bad bro culture. I mean, this was an app that these guys thought up while smoking weed in fraternities, so it definitely reinforced all the most negative stereotypes about this app and this company. But I think Evan has actually grown a lot since then. I was really surprised how many people, when I interviewed them for the book, went out of their way to talk about how those emails and generally this image of Evan as a frat boy during undergrad has changed a lot and grown a lot.
Sure.
And you've seen, I think, since he wrote those at 18 or 19, almost a decade since then, he's gotten married, he has a kid on the way, he's now gone from leading this like project in a frat house to this publicly traded company. And I think if you read some of the internal things he's written and some of those in the book, internal memos about everything from secrecy to the financial strategy for Snapchat to some of his more recent writings when they've had to do downsizing, I think it shows an intellectual maturity there that I think is really impressive. And obviously, he still wrote those things. And so I wrote about this in the book, so I'm like, that's still going to follow him. People will still bring it up, I'm sure, even 10 years from now, something that's kind of hard to get away from. But I do think he's grown and changed a lot.
Well, and it's very indicative of the shift in mindset around the internet that we've had even in the last 5 years of this idea that, you know, we've always known that if it's on the internet, it's permanent. It's a permanent source that could come back and haunt you. But to a certain degree, whether it was intentional or not, it really seems to conveniently inform the grand idea of why Snapchat exists, right? Like, things like that will come around to haunt you, and, you know, whether you've changed or not. Unfortunately, it lives on the internet, and Snapchat allows. Maybe less so now, but initially allowed you to have this type of communication or any type of communication and not have to be concerned about the longevity of its existence.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I remember my my old TechCrunch editor, when those leaks came out, said Evan Spiegel's his own best customer.
Yeah.
And we just saw today, I think the scandal broke that Facebook's deleting some of Mark Zuckerberg's old messages on Facebook. So
right.
Maybe Mark should use Snapchat.
They need to turn Facebook messages into a true ephemeral messenger. Maybe that's the next step. I don't know. Before we kind of dive into more of the history, I want to talk a little bit about Bobby, obviously, because I feel like of the three of them, Bobby, you hear about the least. So I'm curious to ask you about Bobby and then, of course, Reggie, and a little bit more about Snapchat's development. But before we do that, let's thank the sponsor of today's episode of Triangulation, and that is the Ring Video Doorbell. I have the Ring Video Doorbell perched on my front door, and I can't tell you how helpful it is to know when people are coming, when people are going, when people are dropping off packages. It gets used every single day, and I love it. Ring's mission is to make neighborhoods safer. And the Ring Video Doorbell lets you see and speak to intruders on your smartphone from wherever, even share video clips with neighbors using the Ring app. You can kind of create be part of your local network of Ring users in your neighborhood. And if something happens, you share it with them. I've seen that multiple times in the Petaluma neighborhood that I live. Ring's floodlight and spotlight cam actually let you build a ring of security around your entire property. I have one of those right here. It's a nice big piece of kit. You perch this up, and no denying it, you're going to be capturing the video. Super bright lights to shine on the subject. This is the floodlight and spotlight cam, and that lets you build that ring of security around your entire property. Just like Ring's video doorbell, the floodlight cam is a motion-activated camera and floodlight that connects to your phone with high-visibility floodlights, HD video, and two-way audio. It actually lets you know the moment anyone steps on your property. You can see and speak to visitors, even set off a super loud alarm right from your phone. You just hit that button and it'll sound. When things go bump in the night, you'll immediately know what it is. Ring floodlight cams offer the ultimate in-home security. Thieves just can't hide. When you've got a Ring set up, monitor every corner of your property with a Ring of security kit, which includes a Ring video doorbell and your choice of either 1, 2, or 3 floodlight cams, so you can blanket your home effectively. And connect your Ring video doorbell with your favorite smart locks and hubs, and you'll have added convenience, monitoring, and security. Stop crime before it happens and help make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Save up to $150 on a Ring of security kit at ring.com/triangulation. That's ring.com/triangulation, $150 off when you go to ring.com/triangulation. And we thank Ring for their support of Triangulation. So early days, obviously this is still at Stanford. The three guys, the main drivers of this idea historically, I mean, it's Reggie that kind of comes up with the actual idea, right? Like Reggie's the one that you probably don't hear about unless you hear about the lawsuit that that ultimately happened, and he got a big payout, like you mentioned a little bit ago. But he's the guy that had the idea. Can you talk a little bit about how his idea turned into Snapchat and how, you know, Evan and Bobby were able to kind of take that and run?
Yeah. So this is April 2011, and Reggie basically has this epiphany for a sexting app in a way that, if pictures disappear, you can't have the leaks and the hacks of celebrities having their pictures leaked online. You can't have regrets about sending a college fling a picture you shouldn't have. And so he goes to his best friend Evan. Evan agrees to work with him on it. Evan really quickly convinces Reggie to let him be CEO because Evan had worked on products before and had more experience than Reggie. They start trying to find someone who's going to code the app. They go to two other friends of the fraternity, both of whom say no, which is interesting for them now that Bobby's a billionaire. And then they go to Bobby, who just graduated, even though Evan and Bobby had worked on Future Freshman before and hadn't worked. Bobby says yes. So they start coding the app. They move down to Evan's dad's house for the summer and start working on it even more. And Evan over the summer really starts evolving his thinking from building Reggie's sexting app, that's pretty limited use case, into thinking much more around what do we see Snapchat as today. And you see some of his email pitches to reporters and to friends over the summer evolve from, originally it was called Peekaboo, and it'd be a tagline like, Peekaboo lets you send photos to your boyfriend for peeks, not for keeps. And eventually that evolved into he emailed one blogger who he actually later ended up hiring at Snapchat. And he emailed her saying, you and a girlfriend can send back and forth pictures of a dress for you wearing tonight or what outfit you like more. And that really isn't sexting at all. It's much more in line with what we use today, where it's not as important enough to sort of send a permanent photo, but you're using picture messaging to send to converse. So it's really Evan who came up with this idea for what Snapchat is today and saw the bigger possibility in this company. And then over the summer, he was gung-ho on it. He and Bobby were working hard on it. Reggie wasn't working enough, and they ended up having a fight and forcing Reggie out.
Okay, so it was kind of Reggie's actual inaction in developing that idea. Bobby and Evan are the ones that did the hard work. Obviously, they ended up with the company that's making lots of money. But as we said, Reggie gets the settlement. It took a long time for him to get a sort of settlement. Was that resistance from Evan just like saying, like, no, he doesn't deserve it? I mean, he had the idea, so how much is an idea worth?
Yeah, there was definitely resistance from Snapchat on giving Reggie this outsized payout. He got eventually got $157.5 million. There was also a big issue, very similar to the Winklevoss Zuckerberg suit, right, which funnily enough, the Winklevoss twins' lawyers represented Evan, Bobby, and Snapchat in this case.
They've carved out a little niche for themselves, yeah.
Exactly. But in this case, what was so difficult was every month they were in the lawsuit, Snapchat's valuation kept going up and up and up. And so when Reggie first filed his suit, I believe they were valued about $80 million. And then quickly they became $800, and then there was the $3 billion offer. And then by the time they settled, it was over $10 billion. And so it was just so difficult to evaluate, okay, Reggie deserves something for this. Is it $1 million? Is it $1 billion? Is it something in between? And I think that the growth and speed of Snapchat made it really hard to settle on a figure.
Yeah, you just knew it was going to be a big number. And, you know, I personally would say rightfully so. An idea is worth something. Obviously not as much as Evan and Bobby are maybe worth when they put in all the hard work. But I would say I'm happy that that happened. What is he up to now? Where do we know what Reggie is kind of involved with at this point? Enjoying his money, hopefully.
Yeah, enjoying his money. He's keeping a pretty low profile. He did a one-year master's in business at Duke. And then lives currently in his native South Carolina. And so he was a creative writing and English major at Stanford. And I think is not really very much in the public spotlight. So unlike the Winklevoss twins getting into Bitcoin and staying in the public spotlight, he's very much shied away from it.
Yeah, yeah. And you had said earlier he hasn't really spoken publicly about this. I think he's probably barred from doing that based on the settlement. So no getting his perspective on this at that point. Snapchat, so we talked a little bit about kind of the beginnings of it, and it definitely sounds like it kind of came out of this idea of an app that was targeting sexting. But then, of course, that was a narrative that the press has, you know, had for a very long time, and I think by extension the public of trying to understand what Snapchat was really followed through. Is it because of those early days, or is it just because that platform is really effective for that particular use case and people were afraid of that?
I think it's both. I think it's also super interesting that so few tech reporters are of the age of actual Snapchat users.
Yeah, and yeah.
So Evan had a great quote when I first interviewed him, where he's like, as soon as you say the photos disappear, everyone jumps to sexting. And a lot of young people get on and are like, oh, this is actually really fun. I can like send my friends goofy inside jokes or like pictures of myself. You know, a lot of people who got on it were underage drinking and things that are like lewd or like you're not supposed to do, but like no one really cares. But when you're 19, you're like, oh, this is the coolest thing in the world. And so I think that was much more the use case, was like goofy inside jokes and like people partying versus people sexting. But when you're a 30-year-old reporter and you get on the app and you have no friends on it, you don't know how it works. It's not like checking out Twitter where you can see, oh, here's what people are posting. You don't really have any content there to see. And so a lot of reporters just sort of took this narrative and ran with it.
Yeah, yeah. There's nothing to compare it to. So I guess it's low-hanging fruit. You also point out in the book that saying Snapchat, I'm sure many people have classified it as this. It's the perfect app for millennials. But you say that's kind of the wrong characterization. What exactly do you mean by, I mean, I think I know, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts on why that's the wrong characterization.
For sure. I think it's it's way too broad a classification. There are a lot of people who would fall under the age group of millennials that are too old for Snapchat, which I know will scare some of the older listeners. But I think millennials is just too broad. I think the main sort of core use of Snapchat is sort of right now is maybe 13 to 25. And even within those age ranges, there are certainly people in their upper 20s who use Snapchat. And they've said on some earnings calls recently they've had actually strong growth in 35 and above. But I would still say it's sort of a teenage and college and young professional app. And a lot of people are millennials are older than that, or a lot of people who are actually core Snapchat users now are too young to be millennials. So it's just not a super accurate characterization.
Yeah, it's an easy characterization to make, but not accurate. We talked a little bit about Reggie. I'm curious about Bobby, because I feel like anytime I ever read about Snapchat, Bobby's name is perhaps there and represented, but you don't really hear a whole lot about what he's up to and how direct his involvement is. It's way more the Evan show than the Bobby show, it seems like. Why is that? Why do we hear so little about Bobby?
Yeah, definitely. The company is for sure the Evan show. Bobby's a very humble, quiet guy. He doesn't need to be in the spotlight. Doesn't want to be in the spotlight in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And I think it's actually really important that he and Evan's personalities match so well, and he's so willing to be at least publicly the second fiddle. And they very much, especially in the early days, worked well together and were a real partnership. And Evan listens a lot to Bobby, even now, and Bobby's still on the board. But I think the personality match of Evan being so headstrong, believing himself, wanting to be number one, and then Bobby being willing to play that second role, I think is why they worked so well. And then Bobby now is still chief technology officer and leading a small research team, sort of doing special projects, and then is still obviously a co-founder and board member.
Yeah. All right. Cool stuff. So, you know, the title of the book, of course, is How to Turn Down $1 Billion, and which sounds like a ridiculous thing for anyone to ever do if they're ever in that position. I don't know if I could have done it, but it was very interesting to read about the relationship aspects between Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg and Evan Spiegel, particularly, and somehow I missed this over time, but so it was really interesting to kind of do some web searches and read about this even more, was the how little Evan seemed to care that he was being contacted out of the blue by Mark Zuckerberg. There was an email kind of exchange, and it really just seemed like Evan was like, yeah, you know, whatever. If I'm in the area, I'll give you a call. where does Evan's confidence in that decision come from? I feel like anybody would get an email like that from Mark Zuckerberg, and automatically, whether you're interested in a deal or not, automatically you'd be very interested in the fact that Zuckerberg is emailing you. That wasn't the case with Evan. Why do you think that was?
For sure. Part of it's definitely Evan's personality and this sort of cocky, brash personality that drove Snapchat from this silly college room idea to a real Facebook rival. Part of it is also the fact that I think they really saw Snapchat once Zuckerberg contacted them, and they sort of had this impermanence angle as the anti-Facebook and as a company that was fixing what they believe Facebook had created a bad social environment, and that Snapchat was sort of fixing that. And so I think it was sort of this mission of you're doing it wrong, we can do it better, and so we don't have the reverence for you because you're not doing it right.
Yeah, right. And so, of course, those talks went nowhere, obviously. Facebook eventually, and not very long after, launched their app called Poke. I remember Poke. It was not very impressive, but it was obvious that Facebook was trying to, you know, Facebook is good at this, right? Or at least they think they are good at this. They recognize that a competitor, a close competitor, is doing something very interesting, very different, and seemingly almost immediately come up with their own version of it. They don't always succeed. Poke was one of those where they didn't. But I mean, right after that release, Snapchat goes on to basically pummel Facebook in the App Store with Poke. Why did Poke fail so hard when it was trying to basically emulate the things that made Snapchat successful?
Yeah, it took Facebook a while, several years from Poke until they finally hit on something with Instagram Stories.
Right.
To really understand what Snapchat was succeeding with and how they could copy at least parts of it. So the problem with Poke was a perfect clone of Snapchat. It had every feature Snapchat had. It looked like Snapchat. You could even do more actually in Poke than you could in Snap. The problem was that all the people on Snapchat were using it in part because it wasn't Facebook, right? So Facebook had your parents, your all these different people, old people, real adults. And so you weren't posting as much fun things you used to when you were younger. And Snapchat was like your college friends, your high school friends, small group of buddies. And you all posted like really fun things to each other and sent fun things to each other. And so for current Snapchat users, they were like, well, why would I already have my close friends on this app. It's like this weird kooky culture that I like. Why would I go download Facebook Poke and invite outsiders into this club? And then for older people, they didn't understand the appeal of Snapchat in the first place. So they were like, okay, Facebook has this weird like sexting impermanent app. Like I'm 35. Why am I going to go download this? And so they really built an app for no one. And I think that was borne out in the fact that very few people downloaded it and quickly died.
Yeah. And Evan went on to call it a Christmas gift for Snapchat. Happened right around Christmas time. Really seems like that was a point where the perception of Facebook, or at least probably from Evan and team's perspective, shifted to become, I don't know, what did it shift towards? Something, a more serious tool, less of a, like, is that when Snapchat officially kind of was able to leave the whole sexting perspective in everybody's dialogue behind and move into being a more serious product?
Yeah. So it before the sort of narrative was, there's this weird sexting app that's really popular among like high schoolers and college kids, like what's happening? This is bad.
Yeah.
And then when Facebook created a clone, it was like, it totally shifted the conversation to, oh, okay, Facebook copied this. Impermanence must be the next big thing. And so the combination of Facebook copying it and then Snapchat defeating them really validated Snapchat in a big way and created a ton of growth potential for them. And it also sort of positioned Facebook as this sort of 800-pound gorilla in the room. Within about a year and a half, they had bought Instagram for $1 billion, tried to acquire Snapchat, brutally copied them to try to kill them, and then bought WhatsApp for $19 billion. And so that kind of combination of events all in a row was sort of like, okay, Snapchat's going to do anything and everything it can to try to just dominate this space. You know, kind of felt like the end of Goodfellas where they're rounding up all the people involved in the heist and killing them off one by one. It was anyone who's any success in the social or messaging is either coming into the Facebook family or getting whacked.
Yep, absolutely. And I mean, that wasn't the only time that Facebook approached Evan Spiegel for some sort of a relationship. The big one that we all heard about, and man, I remember hearing about this and just scratching my head and being like, how do you turn it down? Zuckerberg offered $3 billion to Evan for Snapchat. Is that confirmed by either Snapchat or Facebook, by the way, or is this something that hit the news and we think we know, but we don't know exactly?
It hasn't. I don't think that either company's like come out with a press release like, yep, this happened.
or any sort of acknowledgement. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's been confirmed by multiple sources. Multiple reporters have had multiple sources confirm it. Okay. And then when the Sony hack happened over the James Franco, Seth Rogen movie, The Interview, the CEO of Sony was on Snapchat's board. And so a ton of board level emails leaked out. And one of those, a few of those were about Facebook's offer. So it's as good as at this point.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Why? I mean, you have to have a lot of confidence about your product then when somebody offers you, probably the biggest name in social media, let's say, and social media, whether Snapchat is social media or not, that could be debated. But the biggest name in your direct competitive field, offers you $3 billion. If you're turning it down, it's because you have the utmost confidence in your product. But that had to have been a difficult decision, right? You don't make that decision. That's not an easy decision to make. How do you think they were able to kind of like, what was their rationale to say, you know what, we can do this better?
Yeah, absolutely. It was not at all an easy decision. We sort of see the publicly facing brash Evan, who's like, we're the best, kind of like a Muhammad Ali saying they're the champ. But in those board level emails we just talked about, one of the board members talks about how Evan sort of was waffling back and forth day after day going, oh, just tell us this is so much money versus, okay, well, I'm going to go it alone. Like, we've got this. It was a really difficult decision. What was really interesting was about a month before the offer, Snapchat launched Stories, which was its feed product. and that started taking off really quickly. Within a year, it was more popular than the messaging app. And so I think they had an early inkling that something's happening here. Sort of the early data showed people are using this. This is going to do well. And that also had a much better monetization potential, as you could put ads into a feed like any other social feed. And so I think they kind of knew there's a good shot here that within a year or two, we have created something that's more valuable than just the messaging app. And I think they also just had confidence in the team, confidence in the idea that impermanence had a place here and that people were going to really enjoy using this. And so, but yeah, it was definitely scary, especially when the first time they turned down Facebook, they just got cloned right away. And Zuckerberg was definitely going to keep copying them, keep coming after them. And so turn them down and realize the sort of battle you're going into took a lot of guts.
Yeah, right. And I don't know. It's no longer too soon to tell whether it was a good or a bad idea. Like the company is now public by all accounts. I'm sure Evan and Bobby are pretty thrilled with the position that they're at. It hasn't been an easy road necessarily. This year has had a lot of challenges. Do you think, I don't know. What do you think? Do you think I would be really surprised if they weren't 100% behind their decision to turn down $3 billion. But do you think deep down they feel that way right now in light of everything that's happened?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think if you look, I think when they went public, the market cap was roughly 11 times what the Facebook offer was. Mm-hmm. Although it's funny, if you do a little back of the envelope map, if had they taken the offer fully in Facebook stock, Facebook's been on a tear since then too. And so it would have been nice to be paid $3 billion in Facebook stock in 2013. But I think more than that, dollar wise, I don't think Evan and Bobby are counting up nickels at the end of the day on what's the biggest amount of money they can make. I think they really enjoy this company on their own. They really enjoy, you look at some of the things Evan's written and spoken about social media and Facebook recently, I think they really enjoy running this on their own. And, we saw this with WhatsApp where Jan Koum, one of the founders who made a lot of money signed to Facebook, said it's time to delete Facebook I wonder if they regret selling and if Kevin Systrom at Instagram or anyone who sort of sold to Facebook wishes they had their independent company back in. And so I think more than anything else right now with all the turmoil happening at Facebook and all the questions that people are asking around the future of social media and tech's influence in our lives, I think Evan and Bobby are really happy that they get to run an independent company.
Yeah, it turns out with the turn of events in recent months, they've got to be pretty happy to be on their own and not be involved in this heavy, heavy conversation that keeps happening. I feel like every day it's a new bit of information about Facebook. Evan even mentioned this. You wrote about his commencement address where he basically admits, like, you want to know how you actually feel about your product. Have someone come along and offer you bucket loads of money for it, and how you respond to that informs, it will tell you deep down how you actually feel. If you rush to sell, then maybe, maybe it wasn't the right product. You may never have a great idea to create another great product again. But if you decide to not sell and turn down $3 billion, that tells you a lot about your own, idea of where you can actually take it. That's like the biggest marker in the world is, no, I don't want $3 billion because I think I could do more with that. That's just a crazy amount of confidence.
Absolutely. And I think that was really good for the company to have that event happen and have the conviction say, okay, we've turned down the offer. We don't think Facebook's going to come back again with another multi-billion dollar offer. Like, we're on our own. We're doing this thing. And I think it was really good for the company.
Sure, sure. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about Snapchat and, of course, talking about how to turn down $1 billion, the Snapchat story by Billy Gallagher. Having a great time talking about Snapchat and learning a little bit more about it. At least, like I said, from my perspective, I'm not a daily user, although the filters are a lot of fun. We'll talk about those a little bit. First, let's thank the sponsor of this episode of Triangulation. That's FreshBooks. This is about enabling you, empowering you to effectively invoice and get paid for the work that you do. You can set yourself up for a stress-free tax season next year with FreshBooks, the easy-to-use cloud accounting software for small business owners. They have an intuitive dashboard. It actually gives you quick access to your spending, your outstanding balances, total profit, and other accounting reports, so you'll know how you're doing at any given moment. It's just right there. Can jump right into it and find what you need. FreshBooks automatically connects to your bank account and even updates expenses on a daily basis for you. And with FreshBooks, you can send professionally looking invoices in seconds. Save time accepting
credit cards online, and even get paid an average of 2 times faster, because we all want to get paid a little bit faster, don't we? You can accept credit card payments directly from your invoice, which makes it really easy for someone to just pay right away when they get that invoice. See what invoices have been sent, viewed, paid, as well as overdue and outstanding invoice totals. You can create proposals and include rich text content, images, customizable sections. Really get in there and tweak it to your perfect standard. Bill for time by client and by specific project. FreshBooks actually recently added Spanish, Dutch, German, and Portuguese languages as options for invoices, estimates, and proposals. So even more ways that you can connect with the people you're working with. And with the FreshBooks app, you can stay connected to your clients and keep tabs on your business no matter where you are. Take a picture of a receipt, upload it, and then you just kind of let FreshBooks do the rest. FreshBooks regularly adds new features. Team member rates can now be managed by through the My Team page, and more features being added all the time. From payment reminders to late fees, automate as much or as little as you like and get back to doing what you love, what you're most effective at. Try FreshBooks free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/triangulation and enter triangulation in the how did you hear about us section. Make sure and do that so they know you're coming from this show. That's freshbooks.com/triangulation. And we thank FreshBooks for their support of triangulation. So obviously for a product like Snapchat or really any social product out there, there's the like gestation time where they're trying to kind of get people used to using it and get this habit created. And Snapchat is great. They've been great at creating habits, for their users with streaks. I mean, they're building in all of these products and all of these functions to get users to incentivize themselves to use it on a daily basis. But the big, payout comes in the form of advertisers and getting advertisers onto your network. We talked just briefly about this before the break. They realized they needed to monetize. That came in the form of advertisers via, stories and Discover. What is so different about Snapchat as a platform that it can monetize with these advertisements in a different way versus kind of what can feel very imposing feel like an imposition on platforms like Facebook? Why is it different on Snapchat?
Snapchat has a really unique product in filters and in lenses. So filters are sort of when you take a really cool picture of the Empire State Building and you swipe to the right after taking it. You can add something that says Manhattan, New York, but you could also add something that's an ad for McDonald's or for Equinox. And then lenses are when you open the app and you hold down on your own face and it pops up with dog ears or makes you vomit rainbows. Those are super fun. And those can also be made into advertisements. So Taco Bell for Cinco de Mayo a couple years ago made people do a taco shell, and 200 million people used it and played around with it. And so that's a much more fun interactive ad to send myself me as a taco shell to my friend instead of seeing some Facebook ad in my newsfeed. Unfortunately, those ads don't scale super well. And so to hit a multi-billion dollar revenue target, you're not going to sort of do that by stacking up Taco Bell taco shells. So as fun as those advertisements are, in a lot of ways, they do need to do some of the more programmatic advertising that that Facebook and Instagram and Twitter do. And so that they've run into some roadblocks there where a lot of times those ads are lower quality and they're not as interesting. So I think they've kind of hit this tension between the user experience and the unique value prop Snapchat has, and then hitting the really high, lofty advertising targets they have.
And also this idea that the advertising aspects of Snapchat are often their own room, so to speak, right? Like it's not like you open the camera and there's a flashing ad down at the bottom, that they've just put a display ad in there for some reason or whatever. You have to specifically go there. And there's probably value to that for advertisers, right? If a ton of Snapchat users are choosing to go into this room where advertisements are, that's high value ad spend versus something in a newsfeed where there it is in the middle. People easily just brush by it because they don't want to see it.
Absolutely. And they've done a good job with creating sort of unique products for advertisers. They had a Discover section where brands like ESPN and Cosmopolitan would put together sort of these curated digital magazines. And when the James Bond film Spectre came out, they gave them their own Discover channel for a day. And so it was this channel that you had to explicitly tap to see what was a paid advertisement. But inside was a movie trailer, behind the scenes footage, all these special things for Snapchat users. And I'm a big James Bond fan. I clicked through and it was really a great experience. And so I think they do a good job of creating these really cool, unique experiences that are not replicated elsewhere. The problem is, again, while those are good money, you're not going to sort of add those up to hit enough revenue. And so it's great and it's exciting, but it's not sufficient.
Yeah, and I guess as a public company, you've got a lot of pressure from your shareholders to just crank it up even more notches. And that's why you need to do that. Instagram Stories, obviously Facebook tried. It tried again, and then it tried again, and they got Instagram Stories through Facebook's Instagram. By all means, a big hit. I mean, now it's seeing somewhere around 300 million daily users. I don't even know how many total users there are on Snapchat, but I'm guessing it's less than 300 million as a flat number. Why has Instagram Stories been able to do this so effectively, been able to, in some cases, out Snapchat Stories?
Yeah. So what Facebook finally figured out was, instead of just wholesale copying Snapchat, which they actually did a second time after Poke with this app called Slingshot that also failed, they finally started actually taking pieces of Snapchat that worked. So they tried out the lenses and the filters in parts of Facebook and Messenger and WhatsApp and different locations. And then they tried out Stories and those aforementioned apps and Instagram. And they just sort of started taking apart Snapchat and trying out the little pieces in different parts of their empire. And Instagram is by far their coolest property. It's used a ton by young people. It's very much considered to be a really cool, fun brand, even more so probably than Snapchat, and certainly by a wider audience. And so they finally hit on this combination of Stories and Instagram, whereas WhatsApp Stories didn't take off or Facebook filters didn't take off. But those failures didn't really matter. They were just sort of testing things out, and now they have hit on a really big one. And in a funny way, they've kind of taken one of Snapchat's core insights and really turned it around on them. So what Snapchat did with Stories early on that was really interesting was they didn't let you like things or comment on things or retweet things or anything like that, but they showed the poster everyone's name who'd viewed the story. So it's very, very different. Obviously, if you tweet something or you post something on Facebook, you don't know who's seen it. But you can kind of get a proxy of that by who's liked it. So even though they didn't show you likes, Snapchat was sort of this addictive posting where you got to see every single person who had seen your story. Instagram took that, copied that completely. And what's really interesting is most people have more friends on Instagram and Instagram's bigger. And so that sort of like psychological hit of, 100 people view my Snapchat story is now, 200 people view my Instagram story. And so Instagram actually managed to basically co-opt that from Snapchat.
Yeah. I mean, friends that I have that use and have used Snapchat quite a bit in the past. Like I've started to hear only in the past year, like, yeah, I'm just not using it as much anymore. I'm totally over on Instagram. Instagram Stories is better than Snapchat Stories. Snapchat has to be, at least to some degree, worried about that fact, right? Like, the big characteristics that made them so unique have now been copied to the point to where there is a flow out from Snapchat and over to Instagram. How big of a threat do you think that is in the long run?
I think it's certainly a big threat, at least to growth. I mean, you see a lot of people who the hope for Snapchat and this growth story told investors was that it was going to expand geographically, it was going to expand age-wise. And I think we still see a lot of people in Snapchat's core demographic who are using Snapchat messaging nonstop. That product's really unreplicated elsewhere. But certainly a lot of people in Snapchat's core demo who are moving over to Instagram Stories. And it certainly hurts growth upwards into older users. I think it'll hurt advertising as well, because as much as people are still using the messaging product, there's no or little advertising in messaging. The only advertising would be through the lenses and filters. There's not actual ads interspersed with messaging. And so if people start using Stories less and posting on Stories less, there's less eyeballs for the advertisers, and that obviously hurts revenue growth. And so I think it is something that's really challenging Snapchat right now.
Yeah, I bet. So yes, obviously filters. I've played around with the filters. It's probably one of the reasons, of the reasons that you can use Snapchat. It's the one that I've used it the most, which hasn't been very much, but I do enjoy the filters. And then of course streaks, geo filters, face filters, all these things to get people to use it on a daily basis. How important is streaks? Streaks seems to me like a really like on one hand, very obvious, like it's obvious, like, yes, you use it this many days in a row to contact this one person. But on the other hand, brilliant, because it incentivizes this daily engagement. How important do you think that has been? And how long has Streaks been around? Has it proven to be a big reason why people are using this on a daily basis?
Yeah, it's surprisingly effective. Again, like you said, really simple, seems obvious and small, but Snapchat does a great job with these little things. They have all these little badges for your best friend, for like people right. who are your top friends, and these streaks that people love that kind of show, oh, we've been snapping each other back and forth for 400 straight days. And it's particularly younger people in high school are obsessed with them and are you know, thousands of streaks long and have like dozens of friends they have streaks with. And yes, it does a great job bringing people back day after day. And you know, again, kind of getting back to those early days of Snapchat being this fun game and fun, goofy place to hang out with your friends. And it's silly, but it's fun. So who cares?
Yeah. Silly, fun, that perfectly describes Spectacles, which, you know, wasn't too long ago. What was that, a year and a half ago? Somewhere around there, Snapchat unveiled Spectacles. 2 years prior to that, we had Google Glass, which I was an early user of Google Glass, and the thing that I loved about it, about the only thing I ever used it for, was the camera aspect, to be able to record a video of something that I'm actually seeing so that later when I watch it, it's like reliving an experience as opposed to just capturing a video with my phone. And it turns out Evan kind of had a similar view of what you get out of Spectacles, right? Yet prior to Spectacles, Snapchat had said, maybe it was Evan said that, you know, was comparing wearing Google Glass to having a gun pointed at you. What was the difference? Like, when did that change happen? When did it go from having a camera on your face, a face camera is like a gun pointed at you, to, hey, we've got this cool new product that everybody on Snapchat should buy?
Yeah, so Evan will talk a lot about how he changes his mind really, really quickly and really easily, and how it can frustrate the team. But yeah, because he has really strong convictions, really strong opinions.
Sure.
But he's willing to change those at the drop of a hat if he thinks something's changed. The big difference that they had with Snapchat versus Google Glass was they had a light on the front of Snapchat Spectacles that would sort of show you if you're being recorded. And so that was a nice way, instead of some of the fear of Google Glass was you're wearing those, like, are you recording me right now? And that was a somewhat elegant solution for Snapchat to show, okay, right now I'm just wearing these as sunglasses, but if I'm seeing something really cool or if I'm at a really beautiful spot, I'm going to hit this button and start recording. But you'll know then, so it's not as invasive. But it was a very interesting turn of events going from, but I think it was about a year, 2 years, I think it was 2 years to the dot almost, that Evan went from Google Glass as a gun pointed at you to, hey, check out these Snapchat Spectacles.
Isn't this a great idea?
Yeah. And now they're coming out with a recent report say they're coming out with a version 2 and working on a version 3 despite the lack of success so far.
Okay, yeah, because, I mean, it definitely felt there was a lot of energy. Snapchat, Snap was very creative in how they marketed Spectacles with the, what is it, the Snapbot box that would end up in different places. It was like a flash sale, you know, creating hours-long lines in order to get the Spectacles. So it was it created a good kind of marketing push around it. It seemed like an interesting product for an app company to come out with. But I remember at the time, I think that was about the time that they were rebranding from Snapchat to Snap as a company. And they were basically saying our grander vision has to do with the camera more than it is the app, that our smartphones, you know, the window into our smartphones' lives is the camera. If you had to guess, like, what do future iterations of Spectacles carry with them that serves that purpose?
Sure. So the idea about being a camera company is really that in the Web 2.0 era, you'd start with the with Google search bar. And eventually that became, for shopping, you'd start with the Amazon search bar. And for friends or news or entertainment, you'd start with a Facebook or Instagram, sort of tap into this feed and search for something. With what Snap's betting on is that the next version will be you start with a camera. And so you have this smart camera that can sort of see around you the way that Siri or Alexa can hear what you're saying, or if you want them to. And we'll start on this camera that sort of like taps through, and you either share something with friends or you can click something to buy. And so that can be on your camera and on your smartphone that you open up Snapchat and you start at that point. But it also could be on Spectacles. And so one of the issues with Spectacles 1.0 was that it had pretty limited functionality. So even though it was a low price point, users didn't really want to buy and wear and charge and keep track of this device when all it could do is record video for just Snapchat. And so future versions, that they can sort of have more computer vision, which is something Snap's been working a lot on, and be able to see what's around you, be able to potentially identify things around you, overlay things with augmented reality, buy things for you. There's a lot of really interesting things they could do where you kind of use that camera on your sunglasses as a starting point to the internet.
Yeah, right. Well, I'll be interested to see. I know you have spectacles. You write about it in the book. You still use them?
I haven't used them in a while. Again, it's a pretty limited use case. I've used them for skiing before, actually, which was super fun. Going down on a really cool ski trail, just like hit record, could sort of see exactly where I was going, and then watch the video later. It's super fun. Very much felt like using a GoPro.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty limited use case. And so I'm excited to see what they come out with for versions 2 and 3.
Absolutely. So I guess in the last few minutes that we have here, we should talk a little bit about where you see Snapchat going into the future. Obviously, you know, spectacles is just one component. I don't know how big of a component their hardware division actually is into the grand scheme of Snapchat and Snap as a company, but how do you think they're going to manage over the next few years? Since they've gone public, it's been kind of a rocky road. They had a good quarter recently, so there's signs of goodness there, but what do you think about the near-term and long-term capabilities of Snapchat as a product and Snap as a company?
I think they're certainly facing short-term issues with the direct comparisons to Instagram. They're not living up to the growth potential and growth story they really sold investors on, and so they're sort of stuck in this headwind against Instagram and Facebook. That being said, they have a lot of good things going for them. They have so many existential crises at Facebook that it doesn't feel like Facebook has the time or energy right now to invest into new products and new product development. So it really does feel like Snap has an opportunity here to be thinking about what is the future of social, what is the future of this company, what can we build that's really unique. What they really need to figure out is what can they build that's defensible, because they might come up with the next really cool thing in social and Facebook is just going to copy it and put it into Instagram or use it somewhere else. And so I think that's also a part of the reason why, despite the lack of success with spectacles, that they are continuing to work on them, because having hardware, having proprietary inputs from the hardware into Snapchat really is much more defensible than creating a new feature for the social app. And so I think we will look for them to figure out what's the strategy with spectacles, what's the strategy with creating something actually defensible. And then finally, I think what they need to figure out is Snapchat this small little community that it's originally intended to be, where you have 100, 150 close friends, or is it more like Instagram, Facebook, where you have 1,000 friends and you follow DJ Khaled and all these crazy influencers and brands, and we have all these advertisements? Because those are two very different things. And so, I think it'll be definitely an interesting year ahead for them.
Yeah, I think one of the bigger challenges that I see, maybe not just for Snapchat, but social media as a category in general, is just this idea that we've seen it all before. We've built up our follower, you know, our followers or our contacts or whatever in these services. It's really hard for anyone new, let's say the next Snapchat or Facebook or Twitter competitor, to come out and do what these companies have done. So from that perspective, it's pretty impressive that Snapchat has been able to pull this off. I feel like we've reached the saturation point with all this stuff, and I don't know how you continue to innovate and stand out from the rest of the pack. Everything just seems to be kind of blurring into one big line together. How do you feel about that?
Absolutely. I mean, it even felt that way when Snapchat first came out. It was like, oh, we have Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Like, do we really need another one of these? And certainly now, where every one of these apps has the same features as the other one, you have Instagram and Snapchat Stories, the most obvious example, but it just feels like you can do all these different things in all these different apps. I think it is interesting, though, how much what the original purpose of the apps were remains sort of the culture around it. So, Instagram Stories, people try to put up this glamorized life because that's what they originally did on Instagram. They post beautiful sunsets and model-esque shots. And so even though you can do the exact same things, people post, I think, a little grittier, a little like real life content on Snap than on Instagram. And so it is funny how the original purpose behind these apps kind of infers what we do on them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then finally, I thought I would kind of ask you, you know, you've spent all this time on the book. The book is out now. What's next for you? Are you thinking, man, I want to jump in and write another book about another company, or are you going in a different direction? What are you working on?
Different direction. I graduated from Stanford's business school in June. I'm actually looking to jump into the fray in the company building aspect of things. So looking to join a really early stage company in an operating role and actually be more in the game than just writing about it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think you'll find some success there. There's certainly a lot of success to be found there, as you learned, I'm sure, through writing this and covering it for TechCrunch. Billy Gallagher, author of How to Turn Down $1 Billion, the Snapchat story. If you want to learn all about kind of the kind of birth of Snapchat, learn a little bit more about Evan Spiegel and company, and it's also a really good insight into how you know venture funding works, how Silicon Valley, the underpinnings of Silicon Valley, and how these companies grow to be as big as they are. It's not just about Snapchat; it's about the whole kind of Silicon Valley and technology economy right now. It's just an excellent read, and you also read the audiobook yourself, so. If you've enjoyed listening to Billy Gallagher on this interview, check out the audiobook, which is what I did. You do a fantastic job reading through the book. Billy, thank you so much for joining me today here on Triangulation, and I wish you the best of luck in everything going forward.
Thanks so much for having me. This was fun.
Right. Take care, Billy. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah.
You can check out all of the interviews that we've done for Triangulation. We've done now 340. Well, this would be 341 here on Triangulation. If you go to twit.tv/TRI, you'll find all of our episodes, ways to subscribe, audio, video, however you choose to get it. If you want to watch live, we record this usually every Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. Today was a little bit different, but it's usually on Friday that we record our interviews live, and you can go to twit.tv/live to check that out. I'm Jason Howell. Find me on Twitter at Jason Howell and all over the Twit Network. It's always fun doing this show. Big thanks to Carson Bondi for producing and for lining up Billy Gallagher for this interview, because I've just had a great time. Thanks for watching, everyone. We'll see you next week on another episode of Triangulation. Bye-bye.